also levied substantial economic damage. Nokia's fall pummeled the entire economy of Finland. The firm's share of the stock market has shrunk from 70 to 13%. What might be next? If you look to the history of Apple and the rest of the four, each started in a separate business. Apple was a machine, Amazon a store, Google a search engine, and Facebook a social network. In the early days, they didn't appear to compete with each other. In fact, it wasn't until 2009 that Google's CEO at the time, Eric Schmidt, saw the conflict of interest collisions ahead and resigned, or was asked to leave, from Apple's board of directors. Since then, the four giants have moved inexorably into each other's turf. At least two or three of them now compete in each other's markets, whether it's advertising, music, books, movies, social networks, cell phones, or lately autonomous vehicles. But Apple stands alone as a luxury brand. That difference presents an immense advantage, providing fatter margins and a competitive edge. Luxury insulates the Apple brand and hoists it above the price wars raging below. For now, I see modest competition for Apple from the other horsemen. Amazon sells cut-rate tablets. Facebook is no sexier than a phone book. And Google's one venture into wearable computing, Google Glass, was a prophylactic, guaranteeing that the wearer would never have the chance to conceive a child, as nobody would get near them. Apple likely has deeper moats than any firm in the world, and its status as a luxury brand will aid its longevity. While the other three companies, the alpha lions on the veldt of high-tech competition, still face the prospect of an early demise, only Apple has the potential to cheat death. Denting the universe. The cocktail of low-cost product and premium prices has landed Apple with a cash pile greater than the GDP of Denmark, the Russian stock market, and the market cap of Boeing, Airbus, and Nike combined. At some point, does Apple have an obligation to spend its cash? If yes, then how? My suggestion? Apple should launch the world's largest tuition-free university. The education market is ripe, and I mean falling off the tree ripe, to be disrupted. A sector's vulnerability is a function of price increases relative to inflation and the underlying increases in productivity and innovation. The reason tech continues to eat more of the world's GDP is a gestalt that says we need to make a much better product and lower price. Education, on the other hand, has largely remained the same for 50 years and has increased prices faster than cable and even healthcare. I teach 120 kids on Tuesday nights in my brand strategy course. That's $720,000 or $60,000 per class in tuition payments, a lot of it financed with debt. I'm good at what I do, but walking in each night, I remind myself we, NYU, are charging kids $500 a minute for me and a projector. This is fucking ridiculous. A degree from a good school is the ticket to a better life. And this ticket is given almost exclusively to exceptional kids from low and middle income U.S. households and any kid from a wealthy U.S. or foreign household. 88% of kids from U.S. households in the top income quintile will attend college, and only 8% from the lowest. We're leaving the unremarkable and unwealthy, most people, behind in a civilization that is now more Hunger Games than civil. Apple could change this. With a brand rooted in education and a cash hoard to purchase Khan Academy's digital framework, as well as physical campuses, the future of education will be a mix of off and online, Apple could break the cartel that masquerades as a social good but is really a caste system. The focus should be creativity, design, humanities, art, journalism, liberal arts. As the world rushes to STEM, the future belongs to the creative class, who can envision form, function, and people as something more. beautiful and inspiring, with technology as the enabler. A key component would be flipping the business model in education, eliminating tuition and charging recruiters, as students are broke and the firms recruiting them are flush. Harvard could foster the same disruption if they take their $37 billion endowment, cancel tuition, and quintuple the size of their class. They can afford to do this. However, they suffer from the same sickness all of us academics are infected with: the pursuit of prestige over social good. We at NYU brag how it's become near impossible to gain admission to our school. This, in my view, is like a homeless shelter taking pride in how many people it turns away. Apple has the cash, brand, skills, and market opening to really dent the universe. Or they could just make a better screen for their next phone. Chapter 4. Facebook. If size matters, it does, Facebook may be the most successful thing in the history of humankind. There are 1.4 billion Chinese, 1.3 billion Catholics, and 17 million people endure Disney World each year. Facebook Incorporated, on the other hand, has a meaningful relationship with 2 billion people. Granted, there are 3.5 billion soccer fans, but that beautiful game has taken more than 150 years to get half the planet engaged. Facebook and its properties will likely pass that milestone before it turns 20. The company owns 3 of the 5 platforms that rocketed to 100 million users the fastest: Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram. You dedicate 35 minutes of each of your days to Facebook. Combined with its other properties, Instagram and WhatsApp, that number jumps to 50 minutes. People spend more time on the platform than any behavior outside of family, work, or sleep. If you believe that Facebook at $420 billion is overvalued, then imagine if the internet privatized and charged per hour. This Internet Incorporated, the company running our digital backbone, then held a public stock offering. What would 20% of Internet Incorporated, the typical amount sold in an IPO, be worth? I think $420 billion is low. Covet. We begin by coveting what we see every day. Hannibal Lecter. Facebook is gaining influence faster than any enterprise in history. And that's because what we covet is what's on Facebook. If you look at the influences that convince a consumer to spend money, Facebook has flooded the awareness stage, the top of the marketing funnel. What we learn on the social network, and especially on Facebook's subsidiary Instagram, creates ideas and desires. A friend posts an image wearing J. Crew sandals in Mexico, or drinking an old-fashioned on the rooftop of the Soho House Istanbul. And we want to own or experience these things too. Facebook gestates intent better than any promotion or advertising channel. Once in pursuit, we go to Google or Amazon to see where to get it. Thus, Facebook is higher up the funnel than Google. It suggests the what, while Google supplies the how and Amazon the when you will have it. Historically in marketing, scale and targeting have been an either-or proposition. The Super Bowl offers scale. It reaches around 110 million people and feeds them nearly identical ads. But the overwhelming majority of those ads are irrelevant to most viewers. You probably don't have restless leg syndrome and are not in the market for a South Korean car. You don't, nor ever will, drink Budweiser. At the other extreme, content presented to a curated group of chief marketing officers over a dinner hosted by eBay's CMO is highly relevant to each person at the table. And the dinner for 10 costs eBay $25,000 plus. It's highly targeted, but not scalable. No other media firm in history has combined Facebook's scale with its ability to target individuals. Each of Facebook's 1.86 billion users, has created his or her own page with years' worth of personal content. If advertisers want to target an individual, Facebook collects data on behavior connected to identities. This is its advantage over Google, and why the social network is taking market share from the search giant. Powered by its mobile app, Facebook is now the world's biggest seller of display advertising. An extraordinary achievement given Google's brilliant theft of advertising revenues from traditional media just a few years ago. The irony is that Facebook, by analyzing every bit of data about us, might come closer to understanding us than our friends. Facebook registers a highly detailed and highly accurate portrait from our clicks, words, movements, and friend networks. By comparison, our actual posts, the ones designed for our friends, are mostly self-promotion. Your Facebook self is an airbrushed image of you and your life, with soft lighting and a layer of Vaseline smeared across the lens. Facebook is a platform for strutting and preening. Users post about peak experiences, moments they want to remember and be remembered by, their weekend in Paris or great seats at Hamilton. Few people post pictures of their divorce papers or how tired they look on a Thursday. Users are curators. However, the camera operator, Facebook, isn't fooled. It sees the truth, as do its advertisers. This is what makes the company so powerful. The side that faces us, Facebook's users, is the bait to get us to surrender our real selves. Connecting and loving. Relationships make us happier. The legendary Grant study at Harvard Medical School has borne this out. The study, the largest longitudinal study of human beings to date, began tracking 268 Harvard male sophomores between 1938 and 1944. In an effort to determine what factors contribute most strongly to human flourishing, the study followed these men for 75 years, measuring an astonishing range of psychological, anthropological, and physical traits, from personality type to IQ to drinking habits to family relationships to hanging length of his scrotum. The study found that the depth and meaningfulness of a person's relationships is the strongest indicator of level of happiness. 75 years and $20 million in research funds to arrive at a three-word conclusion. Happiness is love. Love is a function of intimacy and the depth and number of interactions we have with people. At its best, Facebook both taps into our need for these relationships and helps nourish them. We've all felt it. There's something satisfying in rediscovering someone you knew 20 years ago and keeping in touch with friends after they move away. When friends post pics of their new baby, we get a delicious hit, dopamine. As a species, we are weaker and slower than a lot of our competitors. Our developed brain is our competitive differentiation. Empathy is what makes us more human. The explosion in images distributed on social media platforms has led to more empathy, which should make us less likely to gas children, or at least inspire us to hunt down those who do these things. It's common knowledge that countries that trade with one another are less likely to go to war with one another. As deaths from violence continue to decrease, and they are decreasing, I believe we will discover that one of the causes for the decrease is more people feeling closer to more people. Selflessness and caregiving are key to the survival of the species, and caregivers are rewarded with life. The nuance, emotion, and physicality of caregiving keeps us young, as our camera sees we're adding value to mankind. This is Facebook's vital link to our heart, happiness, and health. A quarter of humanity may populate Facebook feeds with schmaltz and self-delusion, but Facebook also gives users the chance to find love. It turns out that people can send a strong mating signal to their networks just by changing their marital status from in a relationship to single. Word of someone's changed status can race through the network, reaching distant nodes that person doesn't know exist. Facebook analyzes any resulting behavioral changes on the network whenever a customer switches his or her relationship information. Single people communicate more on Facebook. It's part of the preening of courtship. But once they enter a relationship, communication plummets. The Facebook machine tracks this and runs it through a process called sentiment analysis, categorizing positive and negative opinions in words and photos of each person's level of happiness. And as you might expect, coupling significantly increases happiness, though there appears to be a dip following the initial euphoria. It's easy to be skeptical about Facebook, especially with all of the self-promotion, fake news, and groupthink spread on the platform. But it's also hard to deny it nurtures relationships, even love. And there is evidence that these connections make us happier. Watching and listening. In 2017, 1 in 6 people on the planet are on Facebook each day. Users indicate who they are, gender, location, age, education, friends, what they are doing, what they like, and what they are planning to do today and in the near future. A privacy advocate's nightmare is a marketer's nirvana. The open nature of Facebook, coupled with the younger generation's belief that to be is to share, has resulted in a data set and targeting tools that make grocery store scanners, focus groups, panels, and surveys look like a cross between smoke signals and semaphore. That data collector behind the two-way mirror at that focus group that gave you a $75 voucher to Old Navy for participating is about to lose her job. Simple surveys, and they must be simple because people today don't have the time for long questionnaires, are near meaningless in the digital age. When you can measure how people actually behave in their private lives instead of what they report, I always use a condom. This immense learning engine goes well beyond targeting soccer moms on the Nike page. When you have the Facebook app open on your phone in the United States, Facebook is listening and analyzing. That's right, anything you do involving Facebook is likely to be gathered and stored. The firm claims it's not using the data to tailor ads, but to better serve up content you may be interested in or want to share based on what you are doing. Shopping at Target, watching Game of Thrones. What we do know is that Facebook can indeed eavesdrop on ambient noise picked up on your phone's microphone. That means Facebook can feed this noise into AI-augmented listening software and determine who you are with and what you are doing, and even what the people around you are talking about. The targeting isn't any creepier than what happens on the wider web when you have a pixel dropped on your browser and get retargeted ads. That pair of shoes that's following you around the internet? You've been targeted. What's creepy is how good Facebook is getting at it and the number of platforms it can gather and share data across. Double tap a Vans image on Instagram and you may find an ad for those same Vans in your Facebook feed the next day. Creepy is correlated to relevance. I don't need to dive too far into the privacy implications here. That discussion is raging on dozens of other channels. But in general, a cold war between privacy and relevance is being waged in our society. No real shots fired yet, like banning Facebook, but both sides, supporting privacy or relevance, don't trust the other, and it could easily escalate. We knowingly feed corporate-run machines a great deal of information about our lives. Daily movements, emails, phone calls, the whole package. And then expect firms to make good use of it. But to protect, even ignore it as well. Customers thus far have indicated that the utility of these platforms is so great that they are willing to endure substantial risks to their data and privacy. Safeguards on networks are insufficient. Case in point, Yahoo's data breaches in 2014 and 2016. Data hacks are now deeply, inextricably woven into our lives. I use two-step verification and change my passwords often. I'm told that route puts you 99% ahead of people. But I'm still waiting to meet someone who tells me she no longer uses a smartphone or Facebook because of privacy concerns. If you carry a cell phone and are on a social network, you've decided to have your privacy violated because it's worth it. The Benjamin Button Economy. Who are the winners in our algorithmically driven economy? Consider a graph. On the y-axis is the number of people a company reaches. Facebook and Google, of course, are in the exclusive billion-plus club. But plenty of other companies, from Walmart to Twitter to the TV networks, reach hundreds of millions. On that level, they're superpowers. But let's put intelligence on the x-axis. How much does a company learn from its customers? What kind of data do these customers provide? How seamlessly and quickly does it improve the user experience, like auto-populate your destination on Uber, or suggest songs you'll like on Spotify? Over the last 5 years, only 13 in the S&P 500 have outperformed the index each year, evidence of our winner-take-all economy. What do most of these firms have in common? They use the peanut butter and chocolate combination of receptors, users, and intelligence, algorithms that track usage to improve the offering. This is tantamount to a car that becomes more valuable with mileage. We now have a Benjamin Button class of products that age in reverse. Wearing your Nikes makes them less valuable. But posting to Facebook that you are wearing Nikes makes the network more valuable. This is referred to as network effects, or agility. Not only do users make the network more powerful, everyone being on Facebook, but also when you turn on Waze, the service gets better for everyone, as it can geolocate you and calibrate traffic patterns. Where should you work or invest? Simple. Benjamin Buttons. Remember the graph. In the upper right quadrant are the winners, including the three platforms, Amazon, Google, and Facebook. Registering, iterating, and monetizing its audience is the heart of each platform's business. It's what the most valuable man-made things ever created, their algorithms, are designed to do. Newspapers can reach millions, and many more if you consider how their stories pop up on the three platforms. But they gain almost no intelligence from this contact. Thus, while the three dominant platforms, search, commerce, and social, know me upside down, the New York Times has only skeletal details, starting with my address and zip code. It might know I lived in California most of my life, but maybe not. It might try to keep track of my vacation schedule. It sees the stories I read and share, but it's an algorithm targeting a cohort, not a feed-based platform designed specifically for me. Facebook's algorithm can be used to micro-target distinct populations in specific geographic areas. An advertiser can say, "Give me all the millennial women around Portland looking to buy a car." Using data mined from the social media accounts of millions of Americans, Cambridge Analytica, a data firm that worked on Brexit and on the Trump campaign, created a psychographic profile of voters ahead of the 2016 election. The company used behavioral micro-targeting to deliver specific pro-Trump messages that resonated with specific voters for highly personal reasons. With knowledge of 150 likes, their model could predict someone's personality better than their spouse. With 300, it understood you better than yourself. Like the rest of traditional media, The Times let Google handle its search function, until it realized too late its mistake. And so, compared to Facebook, the Times' knowledge of me, a 15-year subscriber, remains bare bones. TV stations know even less. For the 21st century, they're remarkably dumb. And judging by this scheme, dumb companies correlate closely to losers. They were paid to be dumb, as data could have helped advertisers determine which 50% of their advertising was wasted and reduce spend. Some digital companies also lag. Twitter, for example, doesn't know much about its customers. Millions of them have fake names, and as many as 48 million, 15%, are bots. The result is that while the company can calculate changing moods and appetites in different areas of the planet, it struggles to target individuals. It aces humanity, but gets a C in humans. This is the reason Twitter's relevance, similar to Wikipedia or PBS, will always outpace its market value. Good for the planet, bad for Twitter shareholders. No company is higher or farther to the right on this chart than Facebook. It crushes on both reach and intelligence. This power gives it a huge edge in the digital world. Facebook has access to quinine in a mosquito-infested market, digitally savvy talent. Smart people want to work at a dominant company that they think gets it. Its prospects are bright, opportunities everywhere. There are interesting problems to solve and ridiculous amounts of money in play. Few firms had the stones or firepower to drop $20 billion on a five-year-old company, WhatsApp. At L2, we track migration patterns between the largest firms, including traditional agencies and the four. WPP is the world's largest advertising group. Some 2,000 of its former employees have migrated to Facebook or Google. By comparison, only 124 former Facebook or Google peeps left to go work at WPP. Consider the reverse migrants. 124 that went back to WPP. Many of them, it turns out, had only interned at Facebook or Google and went to WPP when they weren't extended offers in Palo Alto or Mountainside. The ad world today is increasingly run by the leftovers. This underscores the dominance of the digital giants. It's not just that their machines are getting smarter day by day as they gorge on our data. They attract the best and brightest. Just look at the infamous gauntlet of intelligence tests that America's job seekers are willing to put themselves through for a job at Google. Getting hired at Facebook is no less difficult, just less publicized. Brains, brawn, and blood. Churchill said that World War II was won with British brains, American brawn, and Russian blood. Facebook has all three. If you're wondering which of the three you are as the customer, it means you're the blood. Consider Snapchat. Many analysts saw the wildly successful camera app as a potential horseman. A brainchild of Stanford grad students, it stormed out of the gate in 2011, offering a way to send instant photos and videos to friends. The added wrinkle was that videos went poof after a few seconds or hours. It was gaffe insurance, and people felt free to share more intimate content, without worrying about it being seen by a future mate or employer. The ephemeral nature of the content also creates a sense of urgency, resulting in better engagement. Cue advertisers salivating. Finally, Snap appeals to teens, a notoriously difficult and influential segment. Snapchat has added lots of features in the months since its founding. It has even pushed into TV, launching a mobile video channel. In 2017, the company is gaining fast on Twitter, and had 161 million daily users when it filed for an IPO. It IPO'd with a value of $33 billion. We'll see. Facebook already is positioning itself to crush the young company. Imran Khan, the company's chief strategy officer, claimed, "Snapchat is a camera company. It is not a social company." I don't know if it's the scorn the Zuck feels after Evan rejected his overtures about acquisition, or a warranted response to a threat. But I believe the first thing Mark Zuckerberg thinks when he opens his eyes in the morning, and the last as he closes them at night is, "We're going to wipe Snap Inc. off the face of the planet." And he will. Zuckerberg understands images are Facebook's killer app, much of it residing in the Instagram wing of his social empire. We absorb imagery 60,000 times faster than words. So images make a beeline for the heart. And if Snapchat is threatening to hive off a meaningful chunk of that market, or even climb into the lead, that threat must be quashed. To do this, Facebook is developing a new camera-first interface in Ireland. It's a clone of Snapchat. In a 2016 earnings call, Zuckerberg said, and this may sound oddly similar, "We believe that a camera will be the way that we share." Facebook has already appropriated, that is, stolen, other Snapchat ideas, including quick updates, stories, selfie filters, and one-hour messages. The trend will only continue, unless the government gets in the way. Facebook is a Burmese python consuming a cow. While the cow goes in, the snake takes its shape. After digesting, it returns to its normal shape, but bigger. Much of this enormous beast is Instagram. Facebook bought the photo-sharing site in 2012 for $1 billion. It's proving to be one of the greatest acquisitions of all time. In the face of ridicule, a billion for a company with 19 people? The Zuck was steadfast and pulled the trigger on an asset that's worth 50-plus times what he paid for it. Whether or not you believe Instagram is the premier platform in its market, it's less of a stretch to acknowledge that it may have been the best acquisition of the last 20 years. And Zuckerberg wasn't as lucky 2 years later. He paid 20 times that for WhatsApp, which had about the same number of employees. One way to appreciate the brilliance of this acquisition is to look at Instagram's power index, the number of people a platform reaches times their level of engagement. This social index reveals Instagram as the world's most powerful platform, as it has 400 million users, a third of Facebook's, but garners 15 times the level of engagement. Facebook's success with Instagram has a lot to do with its speed in adjusting to the market. Its ability to punch out new features is unrivaled. Some of them work: Messenger, mobile app, customized news feed, and some fall flat. The Snoopy short-lived beacon, which would share our purchases with our friends, and the failed buy button. The birthing and killing of new products makes Facebook the most innovative big company on Earth. Less celebrated, but just as important, is Facebook's willingness to quickly back off when it gets pushback from users or the federal government. Facebook knows that its hold on users remains tenuous, despite the considerable effort those users have put into constructing and maintaining their pages. A sexier competitor could still draw them away by the millions, just as Facebook did to MySpace. So, when its endless monetizing initiatives piss off users, as did Beacon, the company quickly withdraws, waits, then probes somewhere else with some other innovation. Jeff Bezos highlighted in one of his famous investment letters that what kills mature companies is an unhealthy adherence to process. Just ask United Airlines CEO Oscar Munoz, who defended his employees who dragged a passenger off a plane, as they had followed established procedures for dealing with situations like this. Much of this innovation comes gratis. Facebook benefits from the ultimate jiu-jitsu move. It will likely become the largest media company on Earth, and it gets its content, similar to Google, from its users. In other words, more than a billion customers labor for Facebook without compensation. By comparison, the big entertainment companies must spend billions to create original content. Netflix is shelling out more than $100 million for each season of The Crown, and will spend $6 billion on content in 2017, 50% more than either NBC or CBS. Yet Facebook competes for our attention and wins it, with pictures of 14-month-old Max curled up with his new Vizsla puppy. This is fascinating to a small audience, maybe 200 or 300 friends, but that's enough. It's easy for the machine to aggregate, segment, and target. So, to extend the analogy, what would CBS, ESPN, Viacom, MTV, Disney, ABC, Comcast, NBC, Time Warner, HBO, and Netflix, combined, be worth if they had no content costs? Simple. They'd be worth what Facebook is worth. Duopoly. Google and Facebook are redrawing the media map. Eventually, they will control more media spend than any two firms in history, separately, much less combined. Most people would agree that, for the next decade at least, ground zero for growth in media spend will be on mobile. Combined, Facebook and Google control 51% of global mobile ad spend, and their share grows every day. In 2016, the two firms accounted for 103% of all digital media revenue growth. This means that, sans Facebook and Google, digital media now joins newspapers, radio, and broadcast TV as sectors that are in decline. Head fake. As they fight for market dominance, both Facebook and Google can be expected to make bold bets on the future. One especially expensive route leads to virtual reality. And that's where Facebook stole the march on the industry. In 2014, Zuck paid $2 billion for Oculus Rift, the leading VR headset company. Following that acquisition, he raved, "VR will open up new worlds." Spoiler alert, it hasn't. People were envisioned strapping on headsets to attend virtual work meetings. Surgeons in New York and Tokyo could operate in the same virtual theater. Grandparents would spend virtual time with their far-flung grandkids. In this way, Facebook would get into our heads. It would usher in a new platform, not just for communication, but for spending time together in virtual worlds. The business opportunity was immense. Following Zuckerberg's lead, venture firms poured hundreds of millions into VR startups. Soon, other tech companies, including the four, were plowing research into the technology. Nobody wanted to sleep through the next big thing. Virtual reality is the mother of all head fakes. The most powerful force in the universe is regression to the mean. Everyone dies and gets it wrong along the way. Mark Zuckerberg has been very right about a lot of things and was due to make an enormously bad call. And he has. Technology firms do not yet have the skills to shape people's decisions on what to wear in public. People care a lot about their looks. Most don't want to look like they've never kissed a girl. Remember Google Glass? It got people beaten up. The bottom line is everyone wearing a VR headset looks ridiculous. VR will be to Zuck what Gallipoli was to Churchill, a huge failure that shows he can be very wrong, but won't slow his march toward victory. The company is still positioned to dominate the global media market and reinvent advertising for the 21st century. Insatiable. A devouring beast, Facebook will continue with more of the same. With its global reach, its near-limitless capital, and its ever-smarter data-crunching AI machine, Facebook, in combination with Google, will lay waste to much of the analog and digital media worlds. A decent proxy for what will happen globally to the media business is what has taken place down under, with traditional media being eaten alive by tech media. In sum, old media isn't going away. It will just be a shitty place to work or invest. A few will hold on. Outfits like The Economist, Vogue, and The New York Times may benefit, at least for a while, because their weaker competitors will die. That and a sudden recognition that truth is a thing again will give them momentary gains in market share. But the operative word is momentary. In the meantime, Facebook will steadily neuter traditional media. The New York Times, for example, gets about 15% of its online traffic from Facebook. The Times agreed to let Facebook post its articles natively on the platform. That means you can read the whole article without leaving Facebook and stepping onto the Times site. The quid pro quo was that the Times gets to keep the ad revenues. Sound familiar? That may sound good, but the reality is that it leaves Facebook in control. That means it can increase or decrease its customers' exposure to the Times as it chooses, and swap in and out other media content when Facebook feels like it. This reduces what was once one of the proudest institutions and brands in American media to a commodity supplier. Facebook decides which content is best suited to convey advertising and who will see it. The Times sprayed bullets across their feet, letting Google crawl their data. With Facebook Instant Articles, The Times and other media firms participating in the program put the gun in their mouth. We have learned nothing. In late 2016, The Times pulled from the Instant Articles program as the revenues were immaterial. So The Times was, again, willing to sell its future, but fortunately the bid wasn't compelling. Oil. If you drill for oil in certain Saudi Arabian fields, it's pretty simple. You stick a pipe in the ground, and the oil that bubbles to the surface is almost pure enough to pump straight into your car. These can't-miss drilling rigs bring up oil at about $3 per barrel. Even in a depressed market, that same oil sells for about 50 bucks per barrel. In the heart of America's growing gas belt, in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, a company haggles with a farmer for the mineral rights to his land, then drills deep into the earth, hoping to hit a certain type of shale. This company has invested in fancy equipment, with drills that can practically turn corners 10,000 feet underground. It's expensive. And if the company finds the shale, it has to surround it with an industrial production, shattering the rock, pumping in thousands of gallons of briny water, and capturing the natural gas that breaks free. This all costs more than the oil equivalent of $30 per barrel. Now, would it make sense for Aramco, Saudi Arabia's national oil company, to divert some of its resources to the fracking fields of western Pennsylvania? Of course not, at least for economic reasons. It would give up about $20 per barrel of profit. Why do that? Facebook faces a similar question. The prime material, the oil, for Facebook is the billions of identities it is following and getting to know in ever greater detail. The easy money is on the sure things in its people portfolio. By comparison, virtual reality goggles, curing death, laying fiber, self-driving cars, and other business opportunities represent much longer odds. If people make it clear with their clicks, likes, and postings that they hate certain things and love others, those people are easy to sell to. Clear as day. Easy as oil in Arabia. If I go into Facebook and click on an article about Bernie Sanders and love one about Chuck Schumer, the machine, expending almost no energy, can throw me in a bucket of liberal diehards. If it wants to devote a little more computing energy to the process, just to be extra sure, it can see that I have the term Berkeley in my bio. So it delivers me with great confidence into the tree-hugger bucket. The Facebook algorithm then proceeds to send me more liberal pieces, and the company will make money as I click on them. Newsfeed visibility is based on four basic variables: creator, popularity, type of post, and date, plus its own ad algorithm. As I consume that content, whether it's think pieces from The Guardian, YouTube clips of Elizabeth Warren expressing outrage at something, or my random friend venting about politics, the algorithm knows what to feed me because it has pegged me as a progressive. But what about all the people who don't express their politics so clearly? How do you sell political stories to them? Many of them are probably moderates, because most people in America are. And they're a lot harder to figure out. For each one, the Facebook machine would need a much more sophisticated algorithm to analyze their friend network, movements, zip code, and the words they use, the news sites they visit. It's a lot of work, and it's less profitable. Moreover, after all the work, it's still not a sure thing, because each bucket of moderates to sell to advertisers is based not on direct signals from those individuals, but instead from a host of correlations. Those always come with mistakes. My neighborhood in Greenwich Village is as blue as they come. Only 6% voted for Trump. Pretty sure that means I'm not just living in a bubble, but a windowless padded cell. However, as far as windowless padded cells go, it's pretty nice. Moderates are hard to engage or predict. Picture a video with some guy in a cardigan sweater discussing, in a balanced tone, the pros and cons of free trade with Mexico. How many clicks would that get? Marketing to moderates is like fracking for gas. You only do it if the easier alternatives aren't available. Thus, we are exposed to less and less calm, reasonable content. So Facebook and the rest of the algorithm-driven media barely bothers with moderates. Instead, if it figures out you lean Republican, it will feed you more Republican stuff until you're ready for the heavy hitters, the GOP outrage, Breitbart talk radio clips. You may even get to Alex Jones. The true believers, whether from left or right, click on the bait. The posts that get the most clicks are confrontational and angry. And those clicks drive up a post's hit rate, which raises its rankings in both Google and Facebook. That in turn draws even more clicks and shares. In the best, worst, cases, we see them daily, the story or clip goes viral and reaches tens or even hundreds of millions of people. And we all step deeper into our bubbles. This is how these algorithms reinforce polarization in our society. We may think of ourselves as rational creatures, but deep in our brain is the impulse for survival, and it divides the world into us versus them. Anger and outrage are easily spiked. You can't help yourself but click on that video of Richard Spencer getting punched. Politicians may seem extreme, but they are just responding to the public, and the anger we are working up daily in our news feeds, our march to one extreme. Clicks versus responsibility. 44% of Americans, and much of the world, turns to Facebook for its news. Yet Facebook doesn't want to be seen as a media company. Neither does Google. The traditional thinking in the market is that they resist this label because of their stock valuations. Why? Because media companies only get a mildly insane valuation, and the four are addicted to iconospheric valuations, hundreds of billions. That way, everyone in their small and select workforces can be not just comfortable or prosperous, but filthy rich. And that's a retention strategy that is always en vogue. Another reason they don't want to be positioned as media companies is more perverse. Respectable companies in the news business recognize their responsibility to the public and try to come to grips with their role in shaping the worldview of their customers. You know, editorial objectivity, fact-checking, journalistic ethics, civil discourse, all that kind of stuff. That's a lot of work, and it dents profits. In the case I'm most familiar with, the New York Times, I saw that editors not only wanted to get the news right, they tried to achieve a balance in the stories they edited. If there was a bunch of news that seemed to appeal to the left, say dreamers being deported or big chunks of Antarctica breaking off and melting, they'd try to get some conservative balance, maybe a David Brooks column attacking Obamacare. Now, people can argue forever about whether the shrinking ranks of responsible media actually achieve balance and get it right. Still, they try. When the editors are debating which stories to feature, they at least consider their mission to inform. Not everything is clicks and dollars. But for Facebook, it is. Sure, the company tries to hide this greed behind an enlightened attitude, but basically it's the same MO as the other winners in the tech economy, and certainly the rest of the four. Foster a progressive brand among leadership, embrace multiculturalism, run the whole place on renewable energy. But meanwhile, pursue a Darwinian rapacious path to profits, and ignore the job destruction taking place at your hands every day. Don't kid yourself. Facebook's sole mission is to make money. Once the company's success is measured in clicks and dollars, why favor true stories over false ones? Just hire a few media watchdog firms to give you cover. As far as the machine sees it, one click equals one click. So entire editorial operations hatch all over the world to optimize production to this Facebook machine. They create crazy fake stories that serve as clickbait for the left and the right. Pizzagate, the story about Comet Ping Pong, a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., got a lot of momentum around the 2016 election. It claimed that the brother of John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, was running a child prostitution ring in the back rooms, hidden from where the customers eat. Lots of people believed it. One guy drove up from North Carolina with an assault rifle, with vague ideas of freeing the imprisoned and abused children he'd read about. He went into the restaurant and fired a shot, though without hurting anyone, this time, and was arrested. The shit sandwich here is that having legitimate news next to fake news has only made the Facebook platform more dangerous. When standing in line at Kroger's, you may suspect Hillary is not an alien, despite what the Inquirer and other supermarket tabloids tell you. However, the presence of the New York Times and Washington Post on Facebook has legitimized fake news. Platform. How can Facebook exert some form of editorial control? A good place to start is with hate crimes. It's easy to be on the right side of that one, and numerically the number of people who want to commit hate crimes is not that high. Facebook will raise its hand and say, "No more hate postings." This way, similar to the rest of the four, company executives can wrap themselves in a progressive blanket to mask rapacious, conservative, tax-avoiding, and job-destroying behavior that feels more Darwin than Elizabeth Warren. Fake news stories are a far greater threat to our democracy than a few whack jobs wearing white hoods. But fake stories are part of a thriving business. Getting rid of them would force Facebook to accept responsibility as the editor of the world's most, or second most, influential media company. It would have to start making judgments between truth and lies. That would spark outrage and suspicion, the same kind that mainstream media faces. More important, by trashing fake stories, Facebook would also sacrifice billions of clicks and loads of revenue. Facebook attempts to skirt criticism of its content by claiming it's not a media outlet, but a platform. This sounds reasonable until you consider that the term platform was never meant to absolve companies from taking responsibility for the damage they do. What if McDonald's, after discovering that 80% of their beef was fake and making us sick, proclaimed they couldn't be held responsible, as they aren't a fast food restaurant, but a fast food platform? Would we tolerate that? A Facebook spokesperson, in the face of the controversy, said, "We cannot become arbiters of truth ourselves." Well, you sure as hell can try. If Facebook is by far the largest social networking site, reaching 67% of U.S. adults, and if more of us each day are getting our news from it, then Facebook has become, de facto, the largest news media firm in the world. The question is, does news media have a greater responsibility to pursue and police the truth? Isn't that the point of news media? As the backlash continued, Facebook introduced tools to help combat fake news. Users can now flag a story as fake, and it will be sent to a fact-checking service. In addition, Facebook is using software to identify potentially fake news. However, with both of those methods, even if false, at most the story is only labeled disputed. Given the polarization of our political climate and the backfire effect, where if you present someone with evidence against their beliefs, they double down on their convictions, a disputed label won't persuade a lot of people. It's easier to fool people than to convince them they've been fooled. We tend to think of social media as neutral. They're just serving us stuff. We are autonomous, thinking individuals, and can discern truth from falsehood. We can choose what to believe or not. We can choose how to interact. But research shows that what we click is driven by deeply subconscious processes. Physiologist Benjamin Libet used EEG to show that activity in the brain's motor cortex can be detected 300 milliseconds before a person feels they have decided to move. We click on impulse rather than forethought. We are driven by deep subconscious needs for belonging, approval, and safety. Facebook exploits those needs and gets us to spend more time on the platform. Its core success metric is time on site, by giving us plenty of likes. It sends notifications, interrupting your work or your home life with the urgency that someone has liked your photo. When you share an article that fits your and your friend's political views, you do it expecting likes. The more passionate the article, the more responses you'll get. Tristan Harris, former Google design ethicist and expert in how technology hijacks our psychological vulnerabilities, compares social media notifications to slot machines. They both deliver variable rewards. You're curious. Will I have 2 likes or 200? You click the app icon and wait for the wheels to turn. A second, 2, 3. Piquing your anticipation only makes the reward sweeter. You have 19 likes. Will it be more in an hour? You'll have to check to find out. And while you're there, here are these fake news stories that bots have been littering the information space with. Feel free to share them with your friends, even if you haven't read them. You know you'll get your tribe's approval by sharing more of what they already believe. The firm is being careful not to inject humans, gasp, or any real judgment into the process. It claims that's an effort to preserve impartiality, the same reason it gave when it fired the entire Trends editorial team. To involve humans would supposedly bring on implicit and explicit biases. But AI has biases as well. It's programmed by humans to select the most clickable content. Its priorities are clicks, numbers, time on site. AI is incapable